Slate Money is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. All Casper mattresses come with free delivery and returns within a 100-day period. Right now, get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/slatemoney and using the promo code SLATEMONEY. And by Trunk Club. Answer a few simple questions about your look, style, and size and receive a trunk full of great-looking clothes that fit perfectly and make you look amazing. Only pay for the clothes you keep, and shipping is free. Go to trunkclub.com/money. And by Goldman Sachs. Get information about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy on the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello! Welcome to the Limited Means edition of Sleep Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm joined, as ever, by Cathy O'Neill, the blogger and data scientist, mathbabe.org.
Hello, Felix and everyone.
Hello, Cathy. And as ever, there's also Jordan Weissman, the Moneybox columnist at Slate.
Hello, y'all.
Jordan wrote something massive for Slate about welfare reform, which is a fascinating topic. I'm slightly being snarky here, but it is a fascinating topic. And because you don't have time to read Jordan's 8 million word article on welfare reform, we are going to talk about it on the podcast and you can just listen to us talk about it instead. We are also going to talk about a victory for the unions.
Yay.
When was the last time we ever heard such a thing? But first, I am going to talk a little bit about an ontological question, I would say. One of the more curious pieces of news of the week, not quite as curious as the fact that Tribune has changed its name to Tronk, but curious all the same.
Are you a Tronk hater?
I am a Tronk hater. I think Tronk is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
I think it's the first time in years that anyone has given a shit about the Tribune company.
Yeah, but they only give a shit because it's stupid. Anyway, yeah. We are not going to talk about Tronk. We're just going to drop the word Tronk randomly into our conversation because no one knows what it means. Instead, we're going to talk about, Elizabeth Holmes, who we've talked about a few times on this show before, the founder of Theranos, the what Matt Levine calls the blood unicorn.
and now the bloody unicorn.
And the fact that Forbes magazine, which for some reason seems to have been granted the power by consensus to determine net worth of anyone rich, has written down her net worth from $4.5 billion to $0 on the grounds that there's a bunch of preferred stockholders ahead of her who've put in about $850 million, and the value of the company is probably around $850 million, so there's really nothing left for her in the event of a liquidation or going public or anything like that. Now, I don't really want to talk about Theranos here because we've talked about Theranos in the past and we have nothing new to add. What I want to talk about is this whole question of how much are you worth as being an interesting question with an actual answer. And what I want to talk about is this question of Elizabeth Holmes being worth $4.5 billion last year. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that Forbes is right, that she's worth zero right now. Does it make sense in any real way to say that last year she was a billionaire and this year she's not? Or have we just kind of discovered that Theranos was a crappy company and therefore she was never a billionaire?
Well, listen, first of all, if you were going to be philosophical about this, then can we actually scrutinize the concept of someone being worth
money? Yes. That's exactly what I want to scrutinize.
I mean, I'm just saying, like, people are worth, they have value outside of their their cash flow.
I'm sure she's a lovely person.
Okay, well, I actually, first of all, are you talking about
like personality capital?
Like, well, I'm just like, as a human being, like we don't say, oh, you're worth, you don't have money, so you're worth nothing.
No,
if you remember the, was it Ken Auletta wrote a big profile of Elizabeth Holmes in The New Yorker, which was full of various Silicon Valley venture capitalists trying to set her up on dates because they were like, you're such a nice person, but you don't seem to have any life outside work.
Well, look, I mean, from my perspective, if you're going to think about things in terms of money and payoffs, this makes absolute sense in the fall. And it's actually a victory for science that it's now worth zero because we thought that there was a lot of shifty science going on. It wasn't evidence-based, and now people have lost faith in it. That's a good thing. The reason we had a high value before isn't because we knew there was going to be payoff. It was because there was like a distribution of possible payoffs, and the high end of that distribution was extremely high because it was expected in that case, which the probability was low, but it was possible that it would disrupt this extremely large industry of testing. Now that the distribution has changed, it's gotten very, very unlikely for that to happen. So the expected payoff is very low now.
Yeah. Or around so, okay, value so, money. So what you're saying is that 1 year ago, Elizabeth Holmes's net worth was a function of a probability distribution,
yes,
which was a real thing 1 year ago. And even though the probability of Theranos being worth hundreds of billions of dollars was low, it was non-zero. And therefore, because that probability distribution was a real thing, Elizabeth Holmes really was worth $4.5 billion.
I mean, it makes as much sense as any sort of option in the market. It has value. Like, there's always the possibility that the world will be destroyed and there will not be a payoff for anything. But yeah, I mean, exactly.
I do think there's some question about, even if the future payoff was potentially worth something on that, you know, probability distribution, what she could have actually extracted from her shares at that moment, right? There's the question of...
Yeah, I mean, no one was saying that she had $4.5 billion of liquid wealth which she could spend on, you know, billionaire whimsy. Well,
exactly. And I think to some extent, and not totally, but when we're talking about someone's net worth, you kind of want to be discussing it in terms of, okay, if this person had to liquidate everything right now, sell off their basically illiquid assets, just, you know, sell everything for a market price, how much cash would they have?
Are we talking about market price or are we talking about liquidation? Because those are two very
different things. That's true. Yeah, I'm sorry. That's actually true because a liquidation, a fire sale, you're going to lose value. But I think essentially—
Because we knew that the $4.5 billion was actually based on the market price.
Well, yeah, it's based on the valuation from their investors. But I think that you want to assume if a person was going to try and sell their shares on the market at that moment— and in their business and whatever, if they're going to sell their home at that moment on the market, how much money would they end up with, assuming that they're not, you know, losing cash because of a fire sale situation? And there's a reason for that. You just want to know how many resources somebody has available to them. It's a calculation, some utility.
I want to ask you the question then. So Kathy's come down in favor of she was worth $4.5 billion. What's your answer to the question of how much was Elizabeth Holmes worth last year?
I haven't sat down with my calculator and green shade to do the numbers, but I think, you know, in the end, it depends on could she have actually sold her own personal stake in Theranos at a given moment for, you know, something akin to what something similar to what the valuation her other investors were giving it. And I don't know that. I don't know that answer.
I'll jump in here and say I didn't actually say she was worth $4.5 billion last year. I didn't personally build that probability distribution even of
the value of her stake. And we're trusting her investors.
Assuming that. I do think there's a little bit more nuance, if you don't mind me going into it, between the difference between a liquidation and the market value of something.
Yeah.
Even when you don't have liquidation, when you're just simply selling your stock, there's impact on the price when you're selling your stock.
Yeah.
It goes down a little bit, even if people aren't like worried about a liquidation sale. So there's like, it is a philosophical question. What does it mean to be worth something because you own things that are quote unquote on the market worth something?
This is, without changing the subject too far, this is very similar to the question which we ran into every day during a financial crisis of, you know, is this bank solvent?
Yes.
Yeah.
And you have a bunch of assets and a bunch of liabilities, and the assets are worth, and then the big question is how much are your assets worth? And then the next question is, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And if the assets are only worth what you could get for them if you had to sell them into a plunging market where no one really wants to buy assets, then you're insolvent. But these things all mean different things at different times. And I think that when you're talking about something like, you know, dynastic wealth by its nature is not something which can or should necessarily be able to be liquidated in the space of a couple of months. It's a permanent thing.
And, you know, and when you're talking about selling it, you're just assuming there is a market for it. And so it comes up to the other question. We talk pretty frequently about how a lot of these startups don't even go IPO. They have no plans to go IPO. So it's not even clear what market it would be selling into to sell these shares.
Yeah, it's true. I think, I mean, as a rule, this kind of philosophical question gets harder for, I think, a lot of ways, the richer people get, because a lot of extremely wealthy people have either their wealth comes from privately held businesses, closely held businesses. The Koch brothers are an example. Koch Industries is their wealth. You know, how do you value that exactly? Is it, you know, up?
Well, I mean, that's something valuable. I'm sure that, that if you gave Warren Buffett the numbers, then he would be able to put a decent number on the valuation of Koch Industries.
Yeah, and you can look at the income stream they get every year. But I'm just saying that when your wealth is bound up in a non-public company, as a lot of very rich people's fortunes are, it does get a little fuzzy, and you do run into these questions.
And I like your point of the larger it gets, the fuzzier it gets, because at some point there are things that are actually so large that the number of possible buyers is very limited. So the question becomes like, who would buy this unless you can break it up into like very small bites.
Exactly, which is one of the interesting things about something like Mike Bloomberg's net worth is basically the value of Bloomberg. And there's almost no one who's rich enough to buy Bloomberg. So then you're talking about hypothetical stock market valuations. But
we used to say that, like, the Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Aramco. But let me just tie this up with the other thing here, which we haven't really touched on, which is not so much the question of net worth, but the question of billionaire status. Because it seems to me that billionaire has a certain meaning, which is not just, well, if you add up all of your assets and you subtract all of your liabilities, then the answer has three commas in it. You know, the billionaire is a certain status of having so much money that you will never be able to spend it all in your lifetime. And Elizabeth Holmes certainly never had that much money. If billionaire means I can, you know, fund whimsical experiments into artificial intelligence and space travel, or decide to bankrupt Gawker Media because I feel like it on a whim, you know, then Elizabeth Holmes was never even close to being a billionaire. And so there are very different types of billionaire in that sense.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite descriptions of the distinction between billionaire and millionaire was a few years ago in an article about the New York club scene. And it was talking about how once upon a time, if you were a millionaire Wall Streeter and you walked into a club, you'd get all sorts of attention lavished on you. And, you know, you'd have, you know, the models coming left and right. And now it has to be a straight B. Otherwise, you're just another guy in the club. And I think that actually...
You have to be a straight B?
Straight bill. Yeah, you have to have a B.
I don't know the lingo.
And so, like, and that was the idea. It's like, if you, you know, there's a certain social cachet now that you have to have this ludicrous sum of money to have. Otherwise, you're just another 100 millionaire.
I guess, like, it begs the question, like, of the people that are, you know, that kind of billionaire that you just discussed that can, like, bankrupt Gawker, for example, what was the moment that they went from the whole Elizabeth Holmes status to their current status?
And I think that's a really good question, but it normally happens, you know, in the case of someone like Peter Thiel, I think it basically happens the day that Facebook goes public.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. So why are they avoiding going public?
Because, yeah, that's a really good question. It wasn't up to him. Anyway, if we have any billionaires listening to this podcast, do write in the email
think we've
address.
Alienated
go public.
That audience.
Just go public.
We email us on slatemoney@slate.com and tell us what the hell it means.
Also,
and
tell
whether
us why you're listening at this point to us. I'm curious if we have any billionaires who are tuning in anyway.
All right. We are going to move on to Kathy's favorite subject, Uncle Jordan's favorite subject. But before we do, I am going to tell you that I really honestly could do with a nap right now.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
That was evident from the moment you walked in.
A rainy, heavy day outside. Can we just all go take a nap?
I feel like if you're driving a car and listening to this podcast right now, don't start feeling sleepy because bad things can happen. We don't have self-driving cars yet. But generally, naps are good things. Sleeps are good things. Try and get more rest. And you know where I'm going with this, don't you?
It's either mattresses or sheets. I don't know.
Yeah, there's actually, given our sponsors, there's a distribution of probabilities here.
This one is mattresses. This one is Casper mattresses, which are the obsessively engineered mattresses made out of springy latex and supportive memory foams. And they're super comfortable and they're super great. And they come in a box. It's incredible technology, and it will get shipped to you for free, and you get to try it out for free for 100 nights, and then if you want to ship it back, you just put it back in the box, or they'll even send you a new box, and you can ship it back, and the whole exercise costs you nothing, but you will sleep really, really well for 100 nights, and obviously why they're doing this and giving you a mattress for free for 100 nights is because they know you're going to love it so much, you're just going to keep on sleeping on it beyond 100 nights because it's going to be a great mattress. Your life is going to be transformed. You're not going to run around in a sort of tweaked, over-caffeinated state, but you're going to be grounded and mindful and productive and all of the things that we want. And you can do it all just by buying the right mattress.
Amazing.
So use my promo code, which is SlateMoney, to get $50 off your Casper mattress. They're cheap. To begin with, you know, they're as little as $500 for a twin and up to $950 for a king. But you get $50 off that. So they'll start just at $450, which is super cheap for this incredibly good mattress. Go to casper.com/slatemoney. Use the promo code SlateMoney. Get your $50 off. Sleep well and then just feel superior to all of the rest of us who can't seem to get enough rest. Kathy,
yeah.
Tell me about.
Listen, I don't six. Would you say 9 million words? It was wonderful, Jordan. I think you did a great job.
It was exactly 4,500 words.
It was great. I had to like pare down my notes to one page. So it contains a lot of information, and I'm kind of just going to ask, if you don't mind, interview you about it.
Yeah, sure.
So as I understand it, like welfare. And, you know, people say welfare, they mean all sorts of things. What we're talking about here started in the Great Depression, right?
Yeah.
Or right after the Great Depression.
Exactly.
AFDC. Can you tell us how it started?
Yeah. So, I mean, typically when we talk about welfare, I mean, like you said, people kind of lump all sorts of different things into it. But for this discussion, we're talking about the program the federal government uses to send cash to the poor, right? And especially poor mothers. And
in fact, it has that in it, right? Yeah. Families with dependent children.
Yeah.
It's only for families with children.
Yeah. And during the
So poor people who don't have children, those like fuck those people basically. This is just if you've spawned.
Basically. This is kind of a feature of America's safety net. We've focused on family sending cash to families with children. In fact,
we can think of it as focusing on poor children.
Yeah, you can in a lot of ways. And so during the Great Depression, the Social Security Act passes and you get this program that became known as AFDC, Aid for Dependent
Families.
Aid for Families with Dependent Children. Actually, if I'm recalling right, even before it became called that, it was just Aid for Children or something like that. There was no families part. But really, it was for widows. It was for widows to take care of their kids. And then over time, the program shifted, and the money was going less to, you know, widows and more to single moms. And that was,
so just to be clear here,
yeah.
the focus is on kids. This welfare, as we're talking about it here, was never a social safety net for Americans to say, if you have no money, then we will make sure you have enough money to live. This is just for short people, basically.
Families. I mean, it was for families. And, you know, in a sense, money's fungible. That's the thing you have to remember. So if you're giving money to the child, in a lot of ways, you're giving it to, you know, his or her mother as well. And there were some married couples also on the program. They don't get talked about as often, but there were some two-parent families that benefited as well.
But it's not for everyone, and specifically, it's not for childless adults.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's the – exactly. And so, you know, now we don't talk a lot about welfare, right? But it doesn't come up a lot. And in fact, that's because of welfare reform, which passed 20 years ago back in 1996. And that's why I was writing this article, kind of looking back at what's transpired since then. But if you look back at the 90s, I mean, welfare was just this huge issue. Bill Clinton, his signature campaign promise was ending welfare as we know it. And that's what he said he was going to do. He was going to limit it so that after 2 years, you were out of the program and you had to go find a job. And that kind of, in a way, defined him as this new Democrat.
Okay, so this is something which, you know, I can't imagine any current Democrat saying. And this kind of, for me, cuts against this idea that the Democratic Party is just moving inexorably to the right. Can you just go back in time a little bit and explain to me what was so bad about welfare that Bill Clinton wanted to end it?
Yeah, well, let me jump in here because you can correct me if I, misrepresent. But as I understand it, there was a huge surge in welfare recipients in the early 90s. The welfare actually peaked in 1994 at 5 million families, 9.6 million children, and almost 5 million adults. And the main point of it is that almost half the recipients were black or brown people. And there was just enormous undercurrent of racism. It's just because it wasn't simply like, oh, we're going to help children. There was this kind of moralistic, we're breeding dependency. We're ruining the family structure. People aren't getting married. Even the charges of people aren't getting married, so they'll be eligible for this stuff. And there was racism.
Yeah, so there was this.
Clinton's stated reason for ending
welfare? What's interesting is there were sort of these two conversations about welfare going up, lots of conversations. And there was one that was sort of driven by race. And if you looked at studies at the time, you know, people's opinions of welfare were kind of tracked to their opinions about black people more generally. And, you know, there was this idea that somehow giving single mothers checks was convincing them not to marry and just have more children and, you know, breed. I mean, there was really a lot of awful rhetoric.
But wasn't coming from Clinton, right?
No. So Clinton, there was this other kind of, you want to say, kind of strain of progressive reformer thought. And the idea was that if you looked at welfare, it actually did have a lot of problems. The program, you know, about a quarter of the women or the families on the program would end up on it for 10 years or more. And that a lot of people just didn't think that that was healthy, in part because the benefits weren't that great. It wasn't a wonderful way for a child to grow up if that was most of their resources. And they weren't really getting much of an example of someone in their household working, things along those lines. And so there was this idea that not only were there inherent flaws in the program, but eventually just the public's kind of disgust with, you know, people being on the dole would just overwhelm it, and eventually welfare would be eliminated. So there needed to be some kind of reform to make this more geared towards getting people onto work.
So the way you said I think this is to Felix's question.
Yeah.
There were the carrots and the sticks, and the progressives were more in favor of carrots, which was like job training and even sometimes job guarantees that didn't make the final bill.
Yeah.
Although what did happen, to be fair, is that welfare reform, a large part of it involved this thing called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which went on to become much bigger than welfare had ever been and has transformed the lives of the poor, not the poorest of the poor, but has transformed the lives of the working poor.
So what's interesting about that, this kind of comes back to what Clinton was trying to do when he showed up in office, right? And he had this idea that he was going to reform welfare. And people talk about this thing, the Earned Income Tax Credit, as part of welfare reform. And this is a huge social policy. It does not get talked about often enough. Essentially, it just it's a refundable tax credit that, you know, boosts after-tax wages for low earners, right?
And to be clear, refundable tax credit is this weird fiscal jargon which no one really means. It's a check.
Yeah, it's a check.
You don't even really need to pay tax to get it. That point about refundable means you just get a check whether you pay tax.
Yeah, but you do need to have a job.
You have to be working.
And the earned income thing is important. An earned income.
And so it makes low-wage jobs much more lucrative. And this was one of the ideas. This had been around for a bit. The idea of expanding this had been part of the sort of notion of progressive welfare reform for a while. And one of the first things Clinton did in office back in 1993 was double it. So this was before, you know, you actually had the real welfare reform bill. He'd already expanded this tax credit, which now is worth about $70 billion a year. Welfare as it exists now is worth about $16.5 billion, right? Just to give you a sense. And the EITC is bigger than welfare ever was. So Clinton comes in, he expands the EITC, and then in 1994, he puts forward sort of a progressive vision of welfare reform after his healthcare attempts had failed. And it involved things like saying, okay, after 2 years, you have to leave the welfare program. You can't keep getting a regular check from the government, but we're going to guarantee you a job or some sort of government-subsidized job. And if we can't get you a job, then you can kind of stay on the program. There are all these exceptions. The problem was eventually Republicans took over. Democrats were already split on this. Republicans take over. And instead, you get this totally different vision called TANF. And TANF is gets rid of the old welfare program, and it creates something called temporary assistance for needy families. And you can talk a lot about what TANF did to try and encourage work. But, you know, I mean, it did things like put time limits on how long you could get welfare to, you know, for 5 years in a lifetime. It did things like require states to ensure that a certain percentage of their welfare recipients are working. But the thing I focus on in my article, and I think is really key to understanding kind of where welfare is now and where it may be going in the future, is they do this thing called block granting, right?
Right. So it's the budget of how TANF is paid for. So whereas the original welfare system was federal government payments.
It was an entitlement. And it was, you know, if you were poor, the federal government and the states were guaranteed to give you a check. They paid for it together. But that safety net, if you were poor enough, was always going to be there. You had a legal right to it.
Well, as long as you had a kid.
As long as you had a kid, exactly. Which is, I mean, that's a lot of families. You know, people tend to have children, and so.
So post the Clinton bill, we have basically lump sums going to states.
Yeah,
and then the states spend those lump sums on a bunch of stuff, which is not cash payments to families.
Depending on the state,
yeah.
And the result of this, because we do need to start wrapping this up, the result of this is that we have created an underclass of families and individuals who are extremely poor and who are getting essentially zero government.
Well, yeah, so I have this. I have a couple statistics. Yeah. So Clinton's bill basically incentivized people to go back to work, but the people who didn't make it back to work went into deep poverty. That's basically the understanding now. So we have almost tripling of the growth in children who live on less than $2 a day since that bill.
Yeah.
And we have 700,000 more children living below half the poverty line than we did then.
And that should be zero. To be clear, the poverty line is a really nasty line, which you should never, ever want to be below. Half the poverty line is just unspeakable. And in an advanced country like the U.S., zero people should be living on half the poverty line.
I should say, you know, the legacy of what TANF did is a little bit complicated in the sense that, you know, most economists have looked at it think actually poverty did decrease partly as a result of these reforms. That regular poverty, right? Like medium poverty. I hate using that term. But, you know, people who are at the threshold, there were fewer people who were right around that threshold because more women went to work, did not rely on welfare checks, whatnot. But the problem that now people are seeing is this issue of deep poverty. And so you have this split, and that's part of the reason why welfare's legacy is so contentious now. On the one hand, it may have actually done some good. But at the same time, it left the people who lost really lost.
So to get into distribution thing, I hope all our listeners like.
So I mean, I want to just let's just finish here with this question for Jordan, which is: are these two sides of the same coin? In order to take as many women out of poverty as welfare reform did and the EITC and all of that, in order to create the positive effects of welfare reform, did you somehow have to create this new incredibly deep poverty underclass, or could you have done the former without the latter?
So this is sort of this kind of wonky historical debate now, but I think no, you didn't have to. I think one of the issues was that the way the funding mechanism works, it gives states so much free realm just to use, quote, welfare money for almost anything they want. I mean, a lot of welfare money now gets spent on things like child protective services, not on things that in any way help the poor. And
it helps poor children, doesn't it?
I mean, we're talking about like adoption agencies and things like that.
Okay.
Like, you know, things like the foster care system that should be funded through state money anyway, instead of helping poor families get to work. And there were certainly ways you could have done welfare reform that ensured states actually spent the money on the people and the projects it was supposed to be spent on. And that didn't really happen. And so part of my message in the end of this article is just that even if you thought that that welfare needed to change and you needed to get more women to work, there were better bills to write. And this kind of legislation we got from Clinton that he basically kind of caved to the Republicans on was one of the worst ways to go about it.
I just want to jump in and one last thing, because the economist, and you know, the researcher in me thinks, given that the states did different things, that we could actually look into this question. Some of the states did really crazy things. Some of them sort of kept on doing the things that were happening beforehand. So we could probably answer that with data.
This is actually one of the most sad parts of the bill itself, right, of Clinton's welfare reform. Before Clinton passed welfare reform, there was this thing called the waiver system where states – and he gave out a lot of these – where states were allowed to start experimenting with different ideas for how to change their system. But they had to do some sort of evaluation. And often – typically that was a randomized control trial. So they had to do a real experimental evaluation. When TANF passed, when new welfare came about, that was no longer required. So you didn't need to evaluate it in the same strict way you had before. So a lot of the opportunities to try and look at what worked were just passed up. And so there are just like a lot of separate tragedies to the way welfare reform was executed. And I just think, you know, the fact that a lot of people talk about it as a model for reforming other parts of the welfare state, like food stamps, is kind of frightening because if you look closely at it, again, even if you agree with the goals, the execution is just really terrible in a lot of ways.
Okay. On which note, we're going to move on to a slightly happier story about paying working class people more money. But first, I'm going to talk about Trunk Club, which is for, I would say, most of the men listening to this podcast. Don't like shopping for clothes.
You're an exception, though.
No, I am absolutely among them.
I'm looking at the incredible outfit you're wearing
today. I am wearing a linen suit, which I had.
Not just any linen suit.
Made in Singapore. No, sorry, in Shanghai. Sorry, that's the most obnoxious thing anyone said for a long time. I am wearing a linen suit, which I got made for me in Shanghai. But no, it was. There's something very personalized about going to get a suit made for you, which is a completely different experience from walking into a store or shopping mall and looking at racks and trying to work out where you can try things on and trying to work out whether they fit. And it's unpleasant. And then you get those weird, like, pushy salespeople who always tell you that you look good even when you don't. And you're second guessing, and it's expensive, and there's something you'd much rather be doing. Mm-hmm. And here's something better,
okay,
which is basically that you get a very friendly person on the internet who's only just on the internet, so they don't pester you in the way that the store assistants can. And they will just ask you, what kind of things do you need? You know, I need a new pair of pants, I need a jacket. Up to and including, I will say, custom tailored suits. They will actually, you can go in and have a proper tailor, like, bespoke make you exactly what you want. If you want a linen suit, you can have a linen suit made and it'll look great. But the core of what they do is off-the-rack clothes, really good ones, high-end ones, which they just talk to you, they get to know you, and then they put them in this little beautiful cardboard box, send it to you in the mail, and you try them all on, and you get to wear them around at home, see whether they're comfortable, think about it for a couple days, put them on, take them off, you know, maybe I want a different color, you know, and then whichever ones you want, you just keep. And then the other ones you just put back in the box, send it back. The shipping both ways is completely free, and it's easy, and it's in your own time, and it just kind of fits into the interstices of your time. People always have more free time when they're sitting around at home than they do when they're out and about, and the idea of going shopping is just this thing which we don't need that anymore.
Yeah, I got to tell you, if I'm in a department store for more than 10 minutes, I get like a coma. I'm in a coma.
I like shopping.
Wow.
Just saying.
Okay, so Kathy, you should. Yeah. You and me, we're like
this for my kids. I have I live with four men who hate shopping.
Yeah,
this is good.
So what you do if you want to try this out, and you should give it a go because it's kind of a fun experience. Is you go to trunkclub.com/money and you just sort of type in your measurements, share your likes and dislikes, and you get your very own personal stylist who will send you a bunch of clothes, and that's it. It's easy, and it's a no harm, no foul. If you don't like any of them, just send them all back. And but you will, because it's great. It's backed by Nordstrom, so they'll have super high quality, super high customer service, the whole thing. Trunkclub.com/money. Give it a go. Jordan.
Yes.
Victory for the working man, or something like that.
Yeah, it was a victory for some working men. No, so the
workers united have suddenly won something.
I was gonna say the labor movement had a victory this week, which is a preciously rare thing. Although less so lately, maybe depending how you define it. But anyway, so Verizon struck a new contract with its union. Right, there had been a massive strike. It was big enough that it actually impacted this month's job numbers. But they. You know, have a new.
It was very visible. I mean, yeah, every time you walked anywhere, all the presidential candidates talked to the Verizon strikers. Well, yeah. Maybe not all of them.
And yeah. Suddenly walking around downtown New York, every Verizon store had pickets outside of it.
It's a big deal.
I mean, it was like 39,000 workers were striking, right? It was by the people who install your landlines, install your cable, and your internet.
So there's really two different classes of workers at Verizon, we should mention.
Yeah, right? So what's interesting about this is they were striking essentially because, well, they wanted a new contract and they wanted to prevent Verizon from doing things like offshoring call center workers, right? Things along those lines. Verizon really has kind of two businesses, right? It's got its job like giving you cable, getting it to your apartment so you can watch Game of Thrones or whatever on HBO. And then it's got its other business that you're familiar with, which is, wireless services. It's got its Verizon stores. And the labor costs for that, cable and internet business are a lot higher because they have all these unionized workers. And so it seemed like Verizon was investing a lot more money into its wireless business, which is not unionized or had not been unionized. And so this new contract is kind of a victory on two fronts. One is the obvious one is that they've gotten all these guarantees now for the cable business. And so they feel like they're going to end up adding jobs. And that's good as far as the union's concerned. But then also, this is a little smaller, but really an interesting point, is that they've managed to also cover a few of the retail store workers in their new contract or with a new union contract. And so it seems like maybe this is a victory in the long and difficult and often failed struggle to unionize retail.
So there's actually only a couple hundred or a few hundred Verizon workers that are now unionized.
Yeah, it's a small number,
but does it open the door for all of those workers to become parts of the union?
I mean, I don't know if it does that, but I mean, it's a step, right? I mean, that's how you have to. These things are incremental. You don't expect it overnight, and. This isn't like, oh, well, Verizon workers are now unionized, so we're suddenly going to see this at the Gap and McDonald's and everywhere else. But, it's just a signal that this is possible. There's this big question hanging over the labor movement over whether you even really can unionize retail workers because they tend to, go in and out of jobs so quickly. They tend, they're temporary, they're part-time. They don't have the same commitment to a day-in, day-out job like a factory worker does. So at least, this is...
Maybe that's because they're not unionized and their jobs suck.
Yeah, maybe. And so this is, it's a step in the direction that labor wants to see.
One of the things I find interesting is that one of the victories of this new contract is they basically force Verizon not to offshore jobs.
Yeah.
And that's obviously a big, big deal in the presidential race right now. And it happened
I'm beginning organizing. To think that the reason why I've not been able to get Verizon Fios at my home is precisely because Verizon had offshored all of the Fios installers. and they're all in France. And then they're like, yeah, we'd love to give you Fios in your home. But unfortunately, all of our workers are in France.
Not every single kind of worker can be offshore. Well, you're right, Felix. So the people that install the wires cannot.
Although to be slightly more serious here, people have spent a huge amount of time looking into this question of why, given the degree to which it's pushing this Fios service and given the degree to which everyone wants Fios, why is it so difficult for people like me to get Fios? And no one really knows the true answer, but a lot of the answer does seem to be that the senior management of Verizon just doesn't like investing in the unionized bits of the business nearly as much as they like investing in the ununionized wireless bits.
I'm just trying to say, and I know we're not allowed to say his name, but
No, we're not allowed to say his name, so let's not.
I'm just saying some presidential candidates are saying, you know, you can count on me to not let jobs leave the U.S. And maybe what we should be thinking is you can count on unions to help prevent that.
So this is interesting. I mean, you know, Verizon's not the first company that struck a deal like this with the unions. A few years, I remember back in 2011, the United Auto Workers did something similar where they said, okay, you're going to keep X number of jobs in the U.S. And the way they do it is saying you have to add X number of jobs to American plants over. And so it's similar with Verizon. You have to add X number of jobs. That way, you know, even if you do send some things overseas, you still have to build the U.S. worker base. So they're not the first ones to do this, but it is I think it's a very popular move by unions. They know it's a really good PR move. You know, part of the problem that organized labor faces is in parts of the country, it is deeply unpopular. There are a lot of corners of the U.S. that hate unions for rational reasons and irrational reasons, mostly irrational in my opinion. But this is one thing that they can do and show that they can do that, you know, I think is probably going to pull really well.
So let me ask you, in the great eternal fight between capital and labor, if this is great for the unions, if this is great for labor, is it fair to assume that the stock market hated it?
No, if I recall right, they did not. No, they did not hate it.
The stock price was going down during the strike.
Because they were like, Verizon's just losing customers, losing opportunities right now because their service is crippled. Which is kind of what the best of all. This is kind of the best of all possible ways the market could react as far as labor is concerned. Because basically, by striking, they brought down the stock price, and then by relenting and signing a deal, the stock price went back up, and so that's kind of the pattern you want to see if you are the communications workers of America.
Win-win-win-win. As far as they're concerned,
yeah.
Okay, so we are going to move on to the numbers round.
Great.
First of all, I need to bring you a message from our sponsor.
Slate Money is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the industries at risk of disruption to understanding bouts of market volatility, tune into Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
All right, Kathy, what's your number?
My number is 7. So I am fascinated by the standardized test system in the United States, the various standardized tests and all the test prep and how we think it's fair because it's standardized, but then, you know, there's inequality that's seeping in because of test prep and other things. Well, we ain't got nothing on China. So there's a 2,000-year-old test called the Hai Exam, also Gaokao. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. It's very competitive to the point where kids will spend about 2.5 years or more just doing nothing else except for preparing for the exam.
It's how you get into the civil service,
It's basically your opportunity to go to be really educated.
Yeah.
And you have to do really well on this test.
How old are you when you take this test?
I think you're at the end of high school, so I want to say 18. Anyway, it turns out that an urban kid is 7 times more likely to get into college than a rural kid, and 11 times more likely to get into an elite college.
So this is interesting.
So there's cutoffs, and the question is who passes those cutoffs?
I'm going to do that thing where I extend the numbers around way longer than Felix wants me to. But anyway, so this is interesting because you always hear about how good Chinese students do on the international tests like PISA, right, that tell, Chinese kids are like whipping Americans. Students, they're so much smarter. But the thing is, those tests are typically based on students in places like Shanghai or even Hong Kong, which is a little separately. But they're based in the coastal urban centers, which are extremely rich, basically first world standards in a lot of ways. And so I think this is
the kids are test prepped to death.
Exactly.
And, so this is and a great they make great suits.
Okay.
Oh my gosh.
I just want to say, so Felix's suit is bright orange. It's burnt.
Pale.
It's like almost burnt orange with some pale orange pinstripes. I think
it's gorgeous. I love it. He's a peacock.
This is the purest expression of Felix's personality, given that this is custom made for him by those students in Shanghai who didn't get into college.
But no, I mean, I think this is a clearly sign of why China's urbanization policy makes sense. If you want people to do better in exams, the thing that you do is you move the population from the rural areas into the cities, which is exactly what China is doing.
You know, what's interesting about that is that the place that the kids have to take the test is based on where their parents are from. So you have a bunch of urban youths actually having to go back to the country to take the test.
Oh, fascinating.
It's really weird. Yeah.
Number, Jordan?
My number is 116,000. We had the jobs report this week for May. It was not good.
Nope.
The number of jobs added was 38,000, although that was dinged a little bit because of the Verizon strike. But even if you double that, like say 70, 80,000, it's still not good. Over the past 3 months, we have averaged 116,000 new jobs per month. The 3 months before then, we averaged 224,000.
And that was healthy, but now it's not.
That was healthy. So we are, everyone's kind of looking at this, and you're not supposed to take month-to-month changes in the jobs report too seriously, but the trend looks like we're slowing down. And really, I'm just hoping the Federal Reserve is watching this, because one wrong move, and I feel like they are accidentally going to make he who must not be named into the president. And like Janet Yellen, if she does, like, there's even an argument at this point they really should be cutting interest rates, because it looks like the economy is slowing down. And if you – the argument, you know, it's this thing called passive tightening. If the economy is slowing down and you leave interest rates where they are, you are effectively tightening interest rates. Some, you know, academics blame the Great Recession on this kind of an effect. I think that's a little overboard, but nonetheless, they do. So right now, I really feel like the Fed should be – very, very thoughtful about how they're handling the economy.
I was the one who said that the Fed is not going to raise rates again this year.
And what the, yeah, what, you the one thing they, that yeah. seems certain in the wake of this jobs report is that they're not going to raise rates in June.
Yes.
So we will see what happens after that.
I want them to drop money on the economy like confetti at this point. Like
from helicopters.
Yeah, from a helicopter.
From helicopters.
Seriously, just through the Canyon of Heroes in New York. Just drop money.
That's the last place we need money. Maybe we should just...
yeah, let's not do that.
Give money to poor people. How about that? That's my idea.
I literally just said it, drop money on Wall Street by accident. That was not my intention, listeners. It just kind of, I was thinking of a sports parade with confetti. Anyway, continue, Felix.
2,520.
What's that?
Is the median size in square feet of a new single family house sold in 2015. This is a number which has been going up and up and up for 30 years and hit a new all-time high in 2015, as it does pretty much every year. Why a typical family in America needs 2,500 square feet, I really don't understand. But this is where we're going.
How many people are living in these households? Is it like, do you still have...
I don't think households are getting any bigger in terms of number
of people. Can you imagine what,
I thought they were, though. I thought, like, nobody's ever leaving home.
Imagine what, like, an Irish family from, like, 1908 New York would think. Like, one of those families that, like, packed, like, 16 into some, like, tenement house.
I know.
Like, if they saw one of these homes, they'd be like,
I guess the other question is, who's buying it, these homes? It's probably not the same people that have all their relatives living with them.
These are new homes, and people who buy new homes are richer. And you know, but the point is the time series. The new homes that people are building are getting bigger and bigger, and are being built for richer and richer families, I guess.
Yeah.
Because like, it's not like the median income has been going up over those
right,
over those years. So I guess what this says to me is that the home construction industry is just going after like a bunch of people who are not normal.
Yeah.
Normal people are not buying new
homes. I think we can all agree on that.
There was this theory that I and other people wrote about after the recession, that in order to cater to millennials specifically, home builders were going to have to cut back on size just because millennials could not afford homes this big.
And developers were like, we're not listening to you.
No, instead they were just like, fuck the millennials.
No. The home builders are one step ahead of you.
Yeah.
The home builders are saying that we're going to sell to people who realize that their kids are going to be living with them into their 30s.
That's true.
You need a whole extra wing just for your kids.
Oh my God, there was such a despicable Wall Street Journal article about, and Shane retweeted it, about these people who are like, their second home is also in Manhattan.
Oh,
it's
God.
It's like a home away from home. It's like, fuck these people.
Yeah.
That's up there with that. That was the other big hate read this week, was the one in the FT about the poor family who's struggling by on £200,000 a year, which is like $300,000 a year.
I mean, there were a lot of those around the Romney campaign where, you know, people were talking about raising taxes on people who made above $250,000 a year. So everyone who made $250,000 wrote a personal essay about how cash strapped they were and how their kids' private school was really draining their finances. It was just...
What I want to find is one of these essays, and these essays come around on a pretty regular basis of, you know, I'm making a six-figure salary and I'm just scraping by. I just want to find one, just one, which doesn't mention private school or school fees. It's always about this like incredibly elite thing that rich people do, which is send their kids to private schools. And take that away and all of these stories just go up in smoke.
They still have rent to worry about, but yes, private school is expensive.
Yeah.
Okay. That is it for us this week. Thank you for listening to Slate Money. Do subscribe to us by searching for Slate Money in the iTunes store. Leave us a review there. Write to us, slatemoney@slate.com. Many thanks to Jason DeLeon, who's recorded the show this week, as well as our producer, Audrey Quinn, and the executive producer, Steve Lichtai, and Andy Bowers, and the whole panoply of Panoply podcasts. iTunes.com/Panoply for all of them. We will talk to you next week on Slate Money.